Welcome to Animal Companions. This is Joyce Vesper, your Radio Reading Service volunteer broadcaster, welcoming you today to Animal Companions, where we read about the animals in our lives and how they affect us. Today I'll be reading another chapter from Masha, My Beloved Monster, Masha the Half-Wild Rescue Cat Who Rescued Me by Caleb Carr. And if we have some time, I'll be reading some newsletters and magazine articles on the animals in our lives. We're going to start today's readings with My Beloved Monster, Masha, the Half-Wild Rescue Cat Who Rescued Me, by Caleb Carr. In the previous chapter, we learned that Masha was transfixed as she watched a big, feral, white tomcat outside the door. This happened many times, but the two did never tangle. Eventually, the tom left, but he was supplanted by the presence of a male golden retriever stud who sat menacingly and tried to chase Masha around. However, Caleb and Masha's cunning eventually fended off the golden retriever stud. And today we start with chapter 22, Two Afflictions, One Struggle. It's sometimes hard to remember exactly when certain developments in Masha's life occurred, because the process of my own sense of time conforming to hers was by then almost complete. Calendar dates and clock hours were growing even less important to me than they'd been when we met, but I can recall noting a definite change in her behavior during the period between my surgery and the initial dogfight. A change that began when her responsible comings and goings on the night that I finally let her roam outside while I sought post-surgical recovery and sleep. Though she still looked the kitten in her face and could still be very playful at times, she had the unquestionably mature face. Siberians, again, reach full adulthood at around age 5, and when I returned from the hospital, Masha was about 6 and a half. This meant that she had been at least 7 when the first encounter with the retriever occurred, and 9 for the second, suggesting that she hadn't in fact been toying with them at all, but rather had been soberly guarding her territory when they took off after her. Above all, it meant that I could trust her judgment more and more. This encouraging sign of maturity had an unfortunate aspect, for with adulthood had come greater discomfort in her hips and hind legs, aggravated by the increased size and especially weight. Arthritis is, of course, a degenerative disease that breaks down joints and bones over time, and the same can be said of internal scar tissue, which, unlike external scars, is of an inferior quality to the original flesh it replaced. She also had neuropathy. Thus, the more sufferers of these conditions insist on high-impact exercise, which chasing, fleeing, and fighting all usually qualify as, in a cat's, as in a person's case, the worse their pain level is. And by the time that Masha's adulthood, the discomfort in her hips and legs was affecting her movements more noticeably, though she continued to hide it most of the time. Meanwhile, her last surgery had only worsened the effects of everything from childhood spinal injuries to adult scars in my torso, as also Marsha and I were traveling parallel paths. It's only in this light that the seriousness of Masha's encounters with the dogs, as well as my encounter to them, can really be understood. At home and at night, our time together in my study was as it had always been, loving, vital, and productive. But the periods we spent roughhousing were getting shorter and were changing. There were no more tackles, though my hands and arms could still take beatings, almost in compensation, but I didn't mind it any more than I ever had. Indeed, whenever I visited my own doctors, I would show off my scars, demonstrating with pride what a wildly living thing I actually lived with. And though their reactions ranged from merely bemused to utterly stupefied, I still felt I was making a valuable sort of point, the same point that I had made in so many situations in my life, whether in the city or the wilderness. Be careful, because I am not entirely well balanced. Masha's yearly visits to the lady vet evolved as well. Cats are rarely taken to the vet as often as they should be. They're amazing, but often unfortunate capacity to live with pain, the trouble of getting them into what are often uncomfortable, and never mind unkindly, carrying cases, and the expense of just their regular treatments and vaccinations, much less anything extensive, leave too many people feeling that, since their cat don't usually go outside, they'll be fine, taking them to the vet only when needed. The problem being, a great many people have no idea when a cat needs a vet's help, often by the cat's design. To show pain is to show weakness, and showing weakness is something that most cats, being solitary animals surrounded by noisy creatures bigger than themselves, feel they must avoid. Masha, largely because of the size of her crate and her affectionate feelings for the lady vet, rarely resisted her regular checkups, until they were underway, of course. And even then, she didn't become violent unless and until something painful or, from her point of view, threatening was done to her. But somewhere between the first and second dog fights, I had to get either confirmation or contradiction of my impression that the hitch in Masha's hip was reappearing more often, and that she was spending more time worrying at her thighs, hind legs, and back paws. What I knew for sure was that she'd begun softly and rather plaintively vocalizing in her tree bed at night, something that didn't tend to happen when I was awake and working, and she slept next to me in her desk-high cat bed. Rather, it began when I'd gone in our bedroom. There, as she tried to sleep herself, little noises impossible to confuse with her snoring. The pair of us often snored, as real discomfort makes almost anyone do. Drifted from her nest, causing me to ask aloud if she was okay. But the instant she heard my words, she would stop, as if to tell me she was fine and that she had no idea whatsoever about what I was talking about, and that I was only embarrassing her. To get an honest answer from my big, tough girl, I needed to try something else. I came up with a method I called the moaning game. When I heard her making a high little sound, I would answer back softly in a like range, not with words, but simple, inflected sounds. It became a call-and-answer sort of thing. If the sound of her voice indicated distress, I would answer with a rising, inquisitive little moan of my own, as if to ask, "It hurts?" And I suspect that because I was not using words, she was taken off guard enough to answer. She would send back a tone that assented, a slightly descending, "Yeah?" Then I would ask her if she needed anything, again not in words, but in the moans that conveyed my meaning. If she answered yes, I would tell her that the medicine was on its way, or if she refused, we would go on making the noises, no longer communicating anything but empathy. After a few minutes, it became a kind of lullaby, and it generally went a long way toward making us both drift off. There were also nights when I set off the exchanges, though usually unintentionally. I'd let out some whine or moan at being unable to find unfindable or at being woken from sleep by pain, and it would be Masha who would answer the inquisitive. None of this, again, was mere babbling, nor was it the thing that I'd learned to dislike and distrust as a boy, baby talk. Rather, it was rudimentary but real communication. Animals who are often spoken to with such words we've long known very often understand the more complicated meanings and concepts behind them. This is not to contradict the assertion that Masha, like most cats, understood a great deal of our actual human language. It's just that when an idea was important to get across to her, it was often best to try both explaining it and reducing it to the key phonetic components so that in the future it could be understood quickly. For example, one key word, outside, Masha grasped in its original form entirely, but in more excited moments she also comprehended its reduced version, side. Conversely, she knew just what home meant, and it needed no explanation. This process became especially important for Masha during her adulthood. She was entering a period during which she would have to adjust to relatively complicated ideas concerning treatment for her ailments and their possible side effects. And meanwhile, would have to use every vocal and demonstrative means that I could think of to not only explain things to her, but even more importantly, to persuade her to give me information about herself. Case in point, what exactly was treat food anyway? On the year's treat to the lady vet, Masha, while in the exam room and as usual on the steel table, as I gently but firmly made sure she stayed there, had displayed an unusually strong desire that nobody so much as touch her hips, thighs, or hind legs and feet. In the process, she'd come close to getting a forepaw free and using the method she often did with me, a swift but clawless punch along with a low growl. She didn't really try to draw anyone's blood that day, but the speed and length of the forepaw did tell all present what was up. The lady vet, who had become very attached to Masha despite the fact that the clientele of her new hospital was 90% dogs, then answered by saying, "Whoa, Mosh, a little wild there, huh?" Then she looked at me, smiling, but wanting to reinforce the point. "You do realize that she's basically wild, right?" "Oh, it's come up," I said pointedly, nodding my hands and forearms as I tried to keep Masha still. "Occasionally." The situation with Masha's pelvis and hind legs on this visit was recognized as being substantially worse when she reacted again with strong, sudden movements. In her maturity, her shoulders, torso, and forelegs had become phenomenally strong, to several more important manipulations of those areas. The usual checks of her internal organs brought whimpers from her as she stared at me beseechingly, but there was no sign of internal disease or dysfunction, and so finally the exam ended. The lady vet moved up to make demands and make amends by scratching Masha's ruff and neck and stroking her head. "Hey, buddy, good job," she said. Genuinely sympathetic, she always seemed to have a good idea of what her patients were going through, which is as rare among vets as it is among MDs. After a few more moments spent seemingly pacifying Masha, she began to speak to me in a more uncertain voice. "Yeah, so it's definitely worse. Even her feet are more painful now, which suggests a certain level of neuropathy." A word that obviously I didn't expect to hear from her. "What? Neuropathy?" she answered. "It's a neural dysfunction." "No, I know what it is," I said, "but that's my diagnosis. Well, part of mine anyway. It's why I have this damned stick." I grabbed my cane from a nearby seat and held it to stop, and a carved panther's lethal head with glass eyes out to her. Oh, yeah, nice," the lady vet said with her usual aplomb. "Is that because of the last book?" she went on, having told me after an earlier appointment that she'd liked the medieval tale. "Well, partly," I said, "but it's mostly to keep me upright, especially when I'm carrying herself in her crate. But has her arthritis really gotten bad enough to cause neuropathy?" "Yeah, unfortunately. She doesn't want me to examine her back paws at all, and there's some matted fur forming on her thighs. Not much yet, but it's getting worse, because she can't reach all the way back to groom her. And I wouldn't try combing them, if I were you. If she doesn't get them cleaned up on her own, you may want to let us clip them off." "Oh, I can do that much," I said, not as confidently as I would have liked. "You sure? She's not going to like it." "Well..." I looked down at Masha's still imploring face as I petted her. I just wish we had something that calmed her down for things like that. Which was going to be my next point. We've tried pretty much everything in terms of anti-inflammatories and muscle relaxants. We know the muscle relaxants don't work, and they hadn't. Masha wouldn't even try them, the smell of the most effective, which I knew was mild, since I had a prescription for it myself, being impossible to disguise even with the human tuna in water from a can. And the anti-inflammatories you said still make her sick sometimes. Yeah, which is too bad, because they really can help. The lady vet was prepared for all of this. Okay, well, we still have one more thing to try. Though it may seem like a big step, a painkiller, but it comes as a tasteless liquid. So if you do what you've been doing, feed it to her in a spoon with flavoring, she should accept it. We can flavor it here, too, but frankly, the flavor we use, that's not great. And since you've already got her used to being spoon-fed with other stuff, it'll be better if you try. And so we did. The medication, butyrophenol, was fairly expensive, and the sale of the book hadn't been what anyone had hoped, but there was never a question of foregoing new medication for Masha because of the cost. Hard times can be recurring consequences of pursuing a line of work that amounts in terms or strategies and pitfalls to professional gambling. And even if it was meant selling things that I had bought when I was flush, chiefly expensive vintage guitars, I would simply do it if it meant getting what she needed. So home we went, armed with a new weapon, which would make Masha more comfortable. I began giving her daily doses when she came in for the night, not wanting her pain to be dulled artificially when she was outside. She might otherwise start believing that her youth was returning and that she would fit to fight another enormous enemy. In addition, I wanted her to be able to sleep more soundly. The butorphanol worked very well, even at a small initial dose, but the most remarkable thing about the experience was how fast Masha came to understand it. She made the connection between an unusually good taste, that of the liquid from a particularly strong tuna canned food that I mixed with the medication, and its beneficial effect, hence the name treat food, a tablespoonful of something that certainly tasted like a treat, but that also, like the hairball treats, whose effect she also understood, made her physical life easier. She also began to get a handle on what she did and didn't want to take, and there were days when she refused it altogether, sometimes annoying waste of a couple of milliliters of the stuff, but again, further proof that Masha was capable of self-regulation. I very much understood this feeling. There were times when I forewent my own medication just to get a brief glimpse of what life had been like before it. But both Masha and I eventually came back because the pain simply never let up and there was nothing else for either of us to do. Which left the subject of Masha having developed neuropathy, not only our lives, but our diagnoses, were still running in remarkable tandem. And there were times when it seemed that our similar affliction had to be explained. For months I thought it was something in the house, in the very air inside the building. Then, when all of the standard tests, random, carbon monoxide, etc., came up negative, and since we both had been afflicted feet, I wondered if the same radiant heat that gave Masha such comfort might somehow be producing long-term toxic effects. I had an air quality testing service come in and run analyses throughout the house, and they did pick up some sketchy readings, but only in the kitchen, where the floor tiling had begun to loosen in a couple of places. Otherwise, the air in the house was fine. I didn't want to accept this, but I had nowhere to go from there, so I shut the kitchen heat off. Something that annoyed Masha enormously, as she disliked eating on cold tile in the winter and demanded thereafter a sheet of cardboard be placed in front of her bowl and left it there. All this reinforced my original opinion of Masha's insightfulness. Somehow she'd sensed that we were two creatures not only similarly troubled when we met, but destined to become even clearer medical reflections of each other. I can't, of course, claim to know just what intellectual and instinctive process gave her such acumen. Her feline sensitivity to chemical emissions, along with her individual ability to judge character, any being's character, all spiced further by her personal wildling power to sense more about situations than even the average house cat, all of these and more likely played parts. What was plainly apparent for the time being was that the butorphanol was helping, so to see her after she'd had a dose, as she walked or sometimes ran around the house so much more easily, as well as to watch her when she slept, with her often pain-stricken face, you learn to see these signs, eyes clamped closed too hard, creating lines under their pump, paws covering the face, forehead pressed tight against something firm, but preferably with a soft exterior. Now smoothed and resting easily, was all nothing short of wondrous. With her discomfort so eased, she would often let me buzz away the mats of hair that continued to pop up on her thighs using electric veterinary clippers. Sometimes when the mats were very close to her skin and especially painful, she would take just so much before letting me have it hard. Swipes, for which, as always, I could not blame her. Overall, however, the new and effective medication for her pain meant that we could enjoy life as much greater extent, or rather, had we been some other human and cat, we might have. But given that it was us, I knew that fate would likely strike again soon, and it was now my turn to get hit. When it came, the episodes were as familiar as they were disappointing, the same stabbing pain in the torso that I hadn't felt since my last surgery several years earlier. Before seeking medical help, I tried, as I'd always done, to determine if my physical troubles were actually the result of psychological factors, and if I might get a hold of them through psychotherapy. Several times a week, I would sit in my downstairs study and talk to my longtime therapist, in whom I'd confided, in person and by phone, from abroad and at home for decades, and try to work out life's stressors, hoping to avoid the hospital. Masha played a part in this therapy, too. Just how cannot, once again, be precisely defined, other than to say that the process must have been putting something chemically or electrically unique into the air. I often sat in the same study chair, reading or talking to people other than my therapist on the phone, while Masha slept up near the top of the Captain Nemo stairs or stretched out on the porch. But whenever it was time for my scheduled therapy appointment, she would descend the metal steps or come in from outside and leap up onto the ottoman in front of me to stare into my eyes with great concern. When this behavior had started, I thought she just wanted treats and I'd offer them to her. Yet she often refused them, clearly wishing only to register her sympathy for my unease. It became another of her most lovable qualities. As the sessions wore on, she'd lie down, just wanting to be present if needed. I eventually became so touched that I began sketching her as she dozed after therapy. And in an effort to capture her look, and just once, I came very close to getting it. Yet the current round of physical troubles once again grew an intense that therapy couldn't ward it off. The spring following the second dogfight, the dreaded pain started coming in more and more frequently, and serious waves soon mounting, a particularly severe attack, aggravated by two stressors. First, the production company in Los Angeles that owned the rights to my best-known book had decided to make it into a television series, but to cut me out of the creative process altogether. And second, the IRS taped a placard to our door saying that the continued failure to pay off my penalties would result in several things, starting with the loss of our house. I think Masha knew that I'd felt very hopeless at the last turn of events, but as always, a look into her worried, urging face reminded me that I had things to do. I called my longtime accountant, who fended off the IRS, then spoke to my L.A. agent, who said she would do what she could to pry money out of the TV show's producers and make them listen to criticism. Finally, I turned again to the subject of the next book. But the stress had hit my insides hard, and the hospital once more loomed large. This time, however, I'd make sure to put various preparations in place that might soften my departure and absence from Masha, so we could avoid the trauma of the last time. I asked two cats, with whom Masha felt safe, to come and stay with her for a couple of days. She knew the basic drill for getting Masha's meds into her, and I left written instructions anyway. Variances from the routine is an unwelcome thing for any cat, much less one with Masha's needs. "Hey, you," I finally said, crouching by Masha painfully as my eldest nephew waited to drive me to the hospital. She looked up at my face anxiously, wide eyes never rounder, as I told her that two cats was on the way. "She'll give you food in the bowl and treat food, don't worry, and then she'll sleep here, and I'll come back soon, after two night times, tonight and tomorrow. You have to be very brave and strong till then, okay?" She jammed her head repeatedly into my hand, so I kept petting her, pleading with me to stay. "I know, it's no good for either of us, but you just keep being big and tough." She turned round and then bumped my side. "Yeah, you monster." I was reasonably sure she understood all this much better than she'd grasped our talk before the big surgery. Separation would confuse her again. Certainly, we still hadn't spent a night apart except during those crises, but she had experience on her side now, which gave me hope, encouraged at least to the extent I got in the car and left. In the hospital, a quick CT scan was all that was needed to pronounce a new illness, or rather an old one now named pancreatitis. The treatment wasn't complicated. Stronger pain meds than I had, along with the fasting IV fluids. I spent much of my time over the 2 days it took my enzyme levels to stabilize, checking on Masha rather neurotically, making sure that Two Cats was following my instructions for taking care of her, and always worrying about my companion's state of mind. This time, however, I was lucky. When I got home, Masha was in good shape. She'd been missing me, Two Cats said, and had often slept on the love seat and ottoman that I used as a bed. but otherwise she'd been very well behaved and at times even sociable. This news and the care that had gone into it was a gift as great as the food that Two Cats had made me in the weeks after the last surgery. And thus assured of Masha's state of mind, I turned to resting on the porch and keeping an eye on her as she began rushing around the grounds nearby. She knew I was weak and I was waning the world to stay away. For taking care of me, as always, I returned the favor by keeping an eye out for her for any serious trouble with a weapon close at hand. But the physical game for me had been significantly upped in stakes, just as Masha recently had. Pancreatitis is one of those most painful and potentially dangerous chronic conditions in which a person can be afflicted. It is also one of the most common originating causes of gallbladder inflammation, meaning the earlier exploratory surgery had, as I suspected, missed the essential mark. The latest attack felt as familiar to me as the earlier one had. I would experience another bout and another brief hospitalization while working on a new book, making it clear that I needed to see a specialist about it. In Albany, I found one, and he would turn out to be a true gift. He took my complete history, and when the talk was over, he informed me that I had certainly had recurring pancreatitis or pancreatic disease all my life. Then he began to ask questions so similar to those posed a decade earlier by the now deceased spinal guru that my mouth fell open. Were you involved in a bad auto accident or other childhood trauma? Once unstunned, I reeled off my story, upon which I learned that pancreatitis or pancreatic disease of lifelong duration is often and perhaps usually the result of childhood injury. Again, the hard blows of our car accidents, other impact trauma, or violence. The problem is that during early and even not so early childhood, the human abdominal wall is thin and sharp blows can cause damage to the organs, which sits just inside the thin wall and mostly outside the protection of the ribs and the sternum. Of course, I told the specialist quietly on hearing this, it had to be. And that's the conclusion of Chapter 22, Two Afflictions, One Struggle, in Caleb Carr's book, My Beloved Monster, Masha, the Half-Wild Rescue Cat Who Rescued Me. Well, that's our reading for today. I hope you enjoyed it, and I invite you back again next time to hear more stories about the animals in our lives and how they affect us. Until then, this is Joyce Vesper for Animal Companions and for Sun Sounds of Arizona. Be well, everyone. Stay healthy. Be happy. Bye-bye.